Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome to a new year with the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 110, being recorded on the 13th of January, 2016. I'm Sujit DeMello, and on Skype with me, I have Kale Teeter and Evan Basilik. Guys, I know we took a week off. We all had some things to take care of last week, so kind of a holiday week, and here we are back in the new year. Well, Happy New Year to all of you and all our listeners, of course.
Yeah, Happy New Year, guys.
And it was kind of interesting. I guess there was a lot of problems with heaters last week, I heard, Kale. what happened?
Yeah, last week I had some problems with my furnace. I had some air in the line. And then I was talking with Evan, and it sounds like he had something similar happen to him as well.
Yeah, right about the time my house fell apart around my ears, if you guys remember, I was out. My heat was out, too. Right. And what it turned out was we had a slow leak somewhere in our system. Our contractor came in and they charged it and they said, hey, we think it might have just been leaking from the valve. We fixed it up. We'll come back in a month and check and see if it's, if your pressure's gone down, then you have a leak and we'll, spend 3 or 4 hours trying to find it. Right. Makes sense. Right. Well, mm-hmm. Of course, whoever notices that your heat isn't working when it's warm. We've had record warmth down here in North Carolina. I don't know about you guys, but it finally got cold last week, and my house was really cold again. So I called them. They came out, and they said, yep, you had a leak, and, once you get below a certain point, it just isn't efficient enough for it to keep up with the cold. And I'm looking at that going, I cannot believe in this day and age that my HVAC unit, somebody doesn't sell, and maybe they do, I have on my list to go look for this, but some sort of add-on for my HVAC unit where it's looking at, efficiency, it's looking at, Freon pressure, and it's either telling me or telling my, somebody I have a service contract with that, hey, it looks like it's leaking, let's get you out here way in advance rather than me having a really cold day. I mean, we've got IoT, all this stuff is there for the Internet of Things, and the transmitters and everything has, can send data in. We've talked on this podcast before about using Stream Insight or, some of the analytics tools to kind of see this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it just, I guarantee you our kids, when they get to be, my age and everything, they're not going to have the problem that I had. I guarantee you those units are going to be smart by then.
I think that's an excellent thought, Evan. I mean, I know both of you had some kind of a heating problem, when the cold weather finally set in. And you guys weren't the only folks. I had a couple of guys in the office, identical issues. Heaters suddenly, started giving trouble just as the cold set in. And it would be nice, yeah. I mean, I'm sure these heaters do have some sort of diagnostic capability. They're just not hooked up to anything right now, or there's no way to monitor them all the time. So, that's a great use case of IoT right there.
Yeah, I mean, that is the classic one, right? And, man, I'll tell you guys, I may not pay it, but I'm sure my wife would pay it. If someone walked up to my house, knocked on my door, said, hey, for $100, a year, mm-hmm. we'll put this on, we'll monitor it. And now, if we come out, it still costs you, normal service calls. But for $100 a year, we'll proactively monitor it. Man, I'd have signed that check in a heartbeat the week it was cold.
I agree.
It just seems like a no-brainer, and I don't know, maybe if I ever get some free time, I'll go see if I can build this thing. All right, just take a little breadboard and, take a Wi-Fi transmitter and just see what I can make. I mean, it'd be kind of cool to do that.
Indeed, definitely. So how was your New Year's? You guys have do something exciting over the holidays?
Nothing really with me. I was at home here and mostly working, so that's my life.
Evan, yeah. I know you were on some long-term vacation, weren't you?
Oh, I took 3 weeks and You know, I gotta say, guys, I just didn't miss you guys. I didn't miss work. It was great. I mean, don't take it personal, but it was
That's
good
awesome.
to just kind of disconnect and just kind of ignore the rest of the world. So, but I had to come up for air at some point. So,
yeah, I agree.
How about you, Sajid?
It was thank you for asking. Yeah, a lot of parties, you know. So I have put on a little bit of weight, I think, over the holidays. Luckily, I got this band too now, so it's getting me back in shape soon.
Okay.
trying to, you know, get active with taking the dog for runs and things like that. So it's nice. Trying to, I guess that was one of my resolutions, is to be a little more healthy, you know, by actively using my Bantu device to keep me in good shape. There's another IoT scenario right there.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, I guarantee you, and you know, I guarantee you that the band team and you know, the phone app side of that, they're using some Azure service somewhere to put that, you know, to get that data from your phone.
Oh yeah.
Into the reporting. Everything.
We actually talked about it. I think one of the episodes you weren't around, Evan, where the band two at least has this auto sleep detection. And the way it does it, that it keeps sending all your heart rate and other information up to some service in the cloud, and and there's an algorithm running in the cloud to detect when you went to sleep based on all that, you know. And so after a while, it comes back, like a few hours later in the day, it'll say, okay, we detected that you slept from this time to this time, and it's very accurate most of the time. Just based on all the volume, you know, all the data that you've collected from your body, or from the band.
Well, and I guess they're using it as a service so that it can get smarter about figuring out when someone's
exactly.
without having to push that code. Oh
yeah,
no, that's
exactly,
cool.
Exactly, right. Yep. So yeah, all right. So I guess we've got a lot of catching up to do. A couple of things. So two areas, essentially. We've got to get our listeners up to date on a lot of updates that happened over the last couple of weeks. And also, if we have time, Cale wants to share some of his real-world experiences that he's had using DocumentDB today. So why don't we get started on that, okay?
Yeah, that sounds great.
So Cale,
sure. On the news side, one thing that kind of jumped out at me was around just recently here, the Azure Automation. So if anybody's used that, it's kind of like our kind of a cloud version of our System Center Orchestrator tool. If you're used to the on-prem version, which allows us to create essentially these runbooks and kind of workflows to execute things for us in batch or at will, ad hoc. And you know, there's ways to kind of build it before. Most of it was driven by PowerShell, so you could write these PowerShell scripts in a correct format, and then you could put those up there into Azure and have them execute them. But now we've added, and anybody that's used Orchestrator knows that there's a nice GUI for that one. Kind of like similar to what we used to have with the workflow designers and things that we had in Visual Studio, where you can kind of Visio it, you know, you can drag and drop boxes and wire them up. We now have that in the browser. So when you come up to the Azure portal, when you're doing automation, you can actually graphically kind of build those runbooks up there and kind of tweak them without writing a lot of PowerShell code.
I mean, this is huge, right? Because this was always one of the stumbling blocks with Azure Automation. You had to write all that stuff by hand. And now you have this lovely GUI editor. I guess they say it looks a lot like the System Center Orchestrator, right?
Yep.
I think some of the guys who do this on premises are probably used to seeing that, and they've now made that available in the portal in a browser. You don't need any special tools to do that, and drag and drop stuff onto the palette, and you can create complete automation there. This is amazing. I think this is going to really help adoption of Azure Automation, which I think we all agree is probably one of the best services out there. And, you know, the one that I liked, Cale, from the list that you put out there, is this Azure Blockchain as a Service. We probably may have talked about this before. I think you may have brought it up before. There's a couple of updates that they've added to it right now. There's new financial companies, I guess, that are starting to use it. BitPay is one of them. BitPay is obviously
do you know, Sajid or Cale, do you have a kind of a working sense of how having blockchain as a service is going to enable a business? Like these companies that are using it, I mean, what does blockchain give them?
Yeah, for me, I'm not an expert in it by any stretch of the imagination. We should probably bring somebody on to talk about it. But
right.
the way I understand it, it's kind of like if you're from back in the days of accounting software, knowing about general ledgers.
Yep.
Yeah, I believe it's around kind of generating, like having a ledger kind of up there in a cloud, but so it can handle the type of strength around financial transactions, that are very, there's a lot of scrutiny around those kind of things.
Yep.
We have to make sure everything completes correctly and how the credits and debits and all that kind of things happens. So I think it revolves around that, but again, I don't have a lot of experience in it. That's my extent of knowledge on it.
Right, and it's a distributed ledger, right? That's the key point. It's not a ledger in one place. So the ledger is kind of it could be distributed, and I guess different companies have their own ledgers, and they eventually your ledger in one company is linked to another, so that it's possible to get.
that sounds dangerous. That just sounds dangerous.
Well, at some point they have to have a single view of you, right? That's the whole idea, I think. They all get linked up in some way. So these companies need a way to host their ledger, Kale put it, and normally they'd have to put up a service and whatnot, right? Upload some code and maybe host a VM and whatnot. Now there's a service out there that does it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because this Azure blockchain feels like a different type of service than some of the other stuff that we look at. I mean, it almost feels like kind of back to some of the original days of Azure when the service that we provide is kind of low level, right? Azure SQL DB or Service Bus or, all that kind of stuff. They, in and of themselves, they weren't really useful.
Yeah, I mean,
right? Versus Azure VMs, I got a VM and now I can do something useful, right? I mean, that's kind of a higher order service. This feels like kind of the old school stuff so now people don't have to do some of the building blocks just to build their stuff that requires it.
Exactly.
Right. So now, and that's cool. But I mean, this feels like we're ahead of the curve here because now people can start inventing things without having to fight the blockchain aspect of it.
Yep. This is definitely very cutting edge. There's no doubt about that. So there's a whole bunch of financial companies that are using it, as well as there's kind of SDKs that are out there that help you integrate with the Azure blockchain, C++ SDKs, et cetera.
So, yeah.
A lot of cool stuff there. And what else you guys like from the list there?
Being a networking guy, I got to go with the network security groups and the new portal. Mm-hmm. We've kind of always had this problem that anything from the Azure service management stuff didn't really surface in the new – a lot of it didn't surface in the new portal. Especially kind of some of the latest and greatest service management features. There were some challenges investing in the classic portal, right? Because we're investing in the new portal. It's hard to do both, but they weren't in the new portal yet. So now network security groups, which are really, really powerful, but are a little bit of a pain in the rear to manage via PowerShell. They're kind of hard to visualize and whatnot, but now the classic doing network security groups with classic resources or service management resources is fully supported in the portal UI, which is great because it's going to make it a lot easier for people to manage those.
That is indeed very good. Yeah. So let's see, Kale, you want to go with one?
Yeah, there's an update to the API management, so that tooling that we had up there. I haven't used any of these advanced features yet, but apparently there's been extensions for the caching mechanism that's used there as well as throttling. So there's some different policies that you can apply now on the cache, I guess, to more granularly control some of the caching aspects of your API calls that are coming in. And then there's also some stuff on quotas and rate limits. So people should take a look at that if they're using the API stuff. Things just continues to add features to it.
Well, in the spirit of our IoT discussion earlier, I like this one about it was kind of like I guess it's some kind of sample code or instructions on how to do this easily, but a way to notify users of data that's received from sensors or other systems. So, for example, if you have that IoT system that's collecting, temperature information from all over the offices within your company, and you need to alert somebody that maybe it's too cold somewhere, or somebody
My
forgot
house.
to, like in Evan's house, or getting cold like it was in Cale's house, before he, what was it, 30, 30 degrees or something before you figured
That wasn't that cold, but
it out. But, something like that, it could alert somebody, send them an email, an SMS message, or something like that. I suppose that's a fairly common scenario, but somebody, I guess one of the, maybe in a PM has put together a kind of list of instructions how to do that easily. So we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, and then there's been a bunch of updates out to Azure, just like GA announcements and that kind of stuff, the Azure automation that we spoke about there earlier. So the desired state configuration is now generally available. So we talked about that, I think, in a couple podcasts on both the Linux side as well as the Windows side. And then the other one that kind of struck out to me was about when premium storage is available in an additional region. I believe it's South Central that it's now available in. So premium storage growing out there.
Now, on the one with DSC, I was reading about that earlier. So this is Azure Automation and DSC, correct? I think, is that the same as just the DSC like we talked about earlier? This seems like,
Well, they're related, right? You
yeah.
can because you can do DSC on its own,
Right.
right? Or you can do DSC as a component of the Azure Automation,
Right.
right? So now, yeah, and this is that's I think that's where this is the GA is coming from this. Is the fact you can do it in the context of Azure Automation.
And this sounds very powerful, right? Because you could deploy, I guess, an entire suite of applications and across various servers, have them all configured the way you want. Is that the end goal of something
Yeah,
like this?
and keep the drift down, right? If people start going up there and they actually have portal access to kind of tweak things,
Right.
as long as you have that thing set up in that automation, you can kind of keep firing that on a schedule and checking to make sure that your configuration isn't drifting.
Right.
And we actually, I mean, that's a we do that at the Azure platform as well. Right, there's a number of things that, like every 5 minutes, we kind of wake up and set all the parameters to what we expect them to be, to actually avoid that. Because you're right, the drift will kill you, right? Or you don't realize that somebody did something wrong in it, and that's what causes all these problems.
Absolutely. Don't we know it from on-premise, actually. That's a big problem. Okay, so so we'll put all those updates in the show notes. But Cale has been doing a little bit of work. Well, he Cale has an interesting scenario he wants to talk about, how he went about using DocumentDB, like what steps he went through before he figured that was the right system for a service for him to use, and then how he went about using it. So, Cale, you want to just take it from here?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I had a scenario. I was working on something totally just on my own with a friend who had an idea about building an application to do something. And so when he came to me and said, how quickly could we get something like this running to kind of just prototype to see if it works and in an agile kind of frame of mind, how quick can we do this? I said, it looks like we could stand this up really quickly. Very, basic application. There was some UI components to it, but very, very minimal. We're going to capture some data from the user. We're going to store that data, and then we're going to allow them to search through that data in some sort of context.
Okay.
So we said, okay, so let's stand up the app. Started standing the app up and said, how are we going to do this search thing? And I said, well, I just seem to remember that we now have full text search for SQL Server at Azure SQL. So we don't have to have a VM or anything running. We can use the PaaS version, the Azure SQL database. So why don't we give that a shot to see how that would work? And it actually worked pretty well. So we come up with a schema, we put it up there, we wired the app up to it, we set up a full text catalog, we went through, built the indexes, did all that thing. And in general, it worked okay. There's some things around the queries, when we started, because basically what we had here, let's say there's 15 fields that this user's going to enter. For argument's sake, I'll just say it's maybe like their first name, last name, address, things like that. So we have a bunch of these fields of data that we're capturing, and we can do full text search over top of those, but it gets a little hairy with the queries, when you start having that many things and you just want to do global search. Like, I just want to search every column. I don't even want to specify what the column is. I just want to search for a city. Next time I'm going to search for a name, but I don't want to specify anything. I just want to kind of like a Bing. You know, I just
want
to come in and search.
Yeah.
So we did that, but it was, you know, we had to write some queries to pull that off with the full text catalog. And then I said, yeah, this is a little bit, I mean, this works, but what about if we looked at DocumentDB? Because I just have a feeling that maybe it's a little easier. Let's try it. Let's see what happens. So set up a DocumentDB, and in the past, my reluctance there and trying to stand up these DocumentDBs is, you know, I'm always a little afraid of, am I setting it up right? Because, you know, thinking back to Azure tables, when we had storage tables, or we still do, well, you have to be careful about how you lay out your partition key and your row keys and how you're indexing, because you can only query it essentially one way.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to come back later and say, actually, I want to query it this way now, well, then in that model, you're actually storing the data multiple times in order to pull that off. So there's different ways, and I don't want to get, you know, beyond the 200 level here, but like when you're thinking about DocumentDB, I bring these up because you will be confronted with it. When you stand up a DocumentDB, one of the things you have to figure out is how you're going to shard, and are you going to use range-based or hash-based algorithm to do that? And some people might get freaked out when they first see that. Like, what is that? Like, what? Okay, I don't know which one it is. And it's pretty simple from that standpoint about how you're physically going to lay the data down. So if you're doing something that goes around dates or ranges like that of data, obviously the range base is going to work. The hash is more of, okay, I want to be able to spread this over multiple nodes in a consistent fashion. And that's kind of been the secret sauce to all these, you know, distributed databases where they have, you know, this massive scale and being able to continually scale and add more nodes and kind of absorb that. And so the hash is actually there to kind of equally distribute those records across nodes that you have inside of your database.
Go ahead. So what process did you use to figure out what hash field to use or fields to use?
Well, you don't have to specify the hash. You just say whether you want to use a range-based or a hash-based.
Okay.
So typically, I mean, just in general, unless you're doing something that revolves around some sort of ranges, you're going to fall back to the hash. Only if I did see those key things. So that's what I'm looking for in the data. Is this something stored by date that I need to do it, or a particular kind of conical range or something that we're going to use? So in this case, the hash worked good. So I said, okay, that's good. But, you know, it's still going to be like, you know, how are we going to search this thing? Like, it's great. We could save data. It's super fast. Everything works great there. But how do we make sure that we can search? So did a little look under, digging around there, and found out that the Azure Search service that we have up there, again, the one that's based on Lucene, that runs up there in Azure, actually has this new thing that's a data source model to be able to pull data in. Now, it's always had that for SQL Server, but there's actually a DocumentDB there. So I was like, that's interesting. Let's see. And basically what you end up doing is you create a query for your DocumentDB that says, you know, just like a SQL query, select star from whatever, and what field you want to pull in. And then that search service, then that's how it knows how to consume data.
So why do you need to – so I was following all that up until you dropped Lucene on top of DocumentDB. Isn't that redundant? I mean, because DocumentDB has the search capability or the ability for searches to come into it natively. So why do you need to put Lucene on top of that?
No, it's a great question. So the reason we were kind of pulling towards that way was you can, and you can do this in DocumentDB too, you can craft indexes inside of there. And that's one of the kind of the features of DocumentDB. But this one actually pulls it out into a component where, so I have my data, I pull it in one time, and then I can have multiple indexers on it. So I can say, hey, let's build an indexer that looks like this, because this is the way some see people. I have this one screen, they're going to query it this way. And then I have another screen where maybe they're going to query it a different way kind of thing.
So like, kind of like non-clustered indexes in SQL.
Sure,
right?
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
But we're pulling the data once, and then we can do whatever we need to over there in search, you know, re-index whatever we need to. So basically you build a connector so that you can talk to your source data. Once you've talked to your source data, though, then it's all in search. So then in there, you can build indexes independent because you have some data set that's cached in there. And then inside of there, you can build on top of that. And this is kind of a neat thing. You can actually build what's called an indexer on top of that. And that's where you can basically schedule it or have it happen real time.
Right.
So you could say, like, every 5 minutes, recalculate the indexes. Now, the thing about the thing that makes this really cool is they actually have, similar to SQL Server with the change data capture, like being able to track what changed. So DocumentDB has the same thing. So they have this nice little hidden field in there that you can grab, and you can put that in your query in your search engine to basically say only query the new stuff or something that changed.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, it makes it super efficient when it goes to recalculate an index. And there's a couple things we bumped into there where, you know, you can do a batch-based, and you can get down to, like, 5 minutes. So you can, the lowest you can make it is, like, every 5 minutes it will recalculate the indexes. Or you could, you know, you can crank it up to whatever you want. Or you can do it real-time. So, like, if somebody, and the nice thing about that is really efficient. So if somebody enters a new record and they hit submit, at that exact point we can just say, take this one document from DocumentDB and index that thing, please. Don't do anything else. Just do that one little thing. At scale, you know, it might be better to do the batch, you know, if you had 10,000 people or 100,000 people doing something at the same time. But it provides a nice, I thought, a nice decoupling of features,
yeah,
right? We have our storage engine over here, and we can kind of figure out how we're going to lay out the storage so that it works good. And then we got over here all this search stuff. And the other thing, I think, Evan, to your point is, the search has also telemetry stuff built into it. So you can enable like some telemetry over there to see what people are searching on, and you can actually
right,
capture some of that stuff there, which is super awesome. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and Lucene is also a relatively – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sajid.
No, good. Continue.
I was just going to say, Lucene is also – I don't want to say necessarily a standard, but it is exceedingly common for that search capability. So you could see that as somebody has existing code. That's maybe the bridge between their existing code and DocumentDB.
Yeah.
Well, it would probably be something else.
And that's sort of what I wanted to clarify. When we say search, right, search means two different things in an application. One is the full-text search that Kayla is referring to. But there's also search for, I want to search for all my products, right, or I want to search for my accounts or my balances or whatever. Mm-hmm. That is a different kind of search. You wouldn't use... You know, you obviously wouldn't use Lucene for that kind of stuff. That is, and I'm assuming that DocumentDB does have a very rich search capability for the latter, where
yep,
you can say, you know, in this table for this kind of key, give me everything that matches this, you know, this name or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a ton of features too. So when you build over in the search side, you can actually set a bunch of attributes on your individual indexes. So when you build an index, let's say you have five things in there, you can say this one's searchable, but maybe this one's in the index, but it's not searchable. You can specify which ones are kind of filterable if you're building kind of a grid type thing where you're going to do some filtering. There's a lot of features that are built. And the other thing you can do is that type ahead kind of stuff, or the search ahead. So like as they're typing, they're getting the results real time coming back.
Yeah.
That does that for you too. I mean, it's literally, it's a very small amount of code, man. It's like the search service, you basically have, like typical, we have a connection string with some sort of a key that we're going to, you know, connect to our search service with. And then we just specify what index we want to use, and we can go to town with, you know, whichever feature we want to use on it.
That's cool. Now, did you, as you were looking through these different kind of avenues, did you look at kind of hypothetical cost for each one? Because that's an element of this as well.
Yeah, and that kind of originally was like, you know, the DocumentDB stuff's really good, but it was like, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit too more expensive. But I got to tell you, I've been running it for a while now. Now, I full disclosure, while we were just testing and prototyping, I'm using the free. So there's a free SKU of the search. There's no free of DocumentDB, to my knowledge. So I'm on the lowest SKU of that. I think it's an S1 is what my database is on. And I couldn't tell you how much that costs per month, but it's really low. It hasn't been chewing that up. But on the search side, I was like, oh, now we have multiple components, right? To your point, Evan, it's like, well, we could either just do Azure SQL Database, or now we got two components. Is that going to be like double? And, you know, there's a free version of the search service. That's what I'm using. But you can only store like up to like 10,000 you know, bits of data in there. In my case, it would be documents.
Yeah.
So that's for testing and doing my stuff. I'm going to do that. But really, there's only two tiers there. The free, and then there's one that's like 250, but it gives you all the options. 250 per month.
250 per month. Or?
Yeah.
So I think that to me is one of the things that, you know, I see some customers kind of run into the trap of they go leverage. You know, I've always used relational databases, so you know what, I kind of get cloud, that I understand that I don't want to necessarily stand up an IaaS VM and install SQL Server, so I'm going to use SQL PaaS, and you know, kind of save some of the management stuff. But they don't quite take that next step and say, hey, can I leverage some other completely different services that I'm ever used to using, that I have some way to get through a common API, Lucene or something like that, right? And really dramatically drive down the cost or change that cost profile in such a way that, like, you know, I could scale up and scale down on the weekends, you know, and maybe I couldn't do that, you know, with architecture A, but I can do that with architecture B. Right.
Yeah, I think the other use case is that you mentioned before, which about Lucene being pretty popular as a source for a lot of different engines, and one of them Solr, the people from the open source world know. And so, you know, I've been in situations where people were using Solr, and that's not necessarily trivial to set up. You know, there's some setup to get each server going, but you got to think about redundancy, and now you got to have something to manage that cluster, and typically people use ZooKeeper, but you know, now you got more software to manage, you know, so there's, you keep piling those things on, and yeah, you can technically do it and run it all in IaaS, but, and maybe the PaaS version again doesn't have every single feature that you could do if you were running it like kind of bare metal on IaaS kind of thing, but you know, does it work enough? Like, does it fit actually where the big features that you need? So I think that's something people should look at.
Yep. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think all these, I guess these are all PaaS services, right? I mean, is that the right word to use?
Yeah.
You know, different kinds of PaaS services. And I think we all agree that that is the holy grail of going to the cloud, is using PaaS services. So, most certainly, that's the way to go. Well, Cale, that was very educational for me, at least. Thank you for explaining that. I'm sure that'll give our listeners something to think about, and give me something to think about as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Cale. I swear, Cale, I thought I was pretty broad from a kind of a code base and running into different things, but man, every time you talk about some of the stuff you're doing in real world, I have to go look up yet another open source thing that you're playing with.
And how, yeah, that world is big, man.
Talking about pricing and all that, how is DocumentDB priced? Like, what is it based on the number of queries that you do, or is it some kind of a capacity unit?
Yeah, they have different levels, similar to some of the other stuff we have, even like type VMs like S1, S2, S3, that give you more capacity, more speed. More shards, like more replication. So on the lower end of the scale, obviously you're not getting all those kind of things. And then as you want to kind of mature and have it, you know, expand and have multiple, you know, like backup replicas of your data and that kind of stuff, that's kind of the way it's priced.
Yeah, it looks like I just pulled it up as we were talking, and it looks like you go from the S1, which is, and I'm not exactly sure what a request unit is, but some count of requests. Lowest one, which is 250 units a second, is, you know, 3.5 cents an hour, so about $25 a month. The highest, the S3, is 2,500 units a second, and then in that case, you're up to about $100 a month.
Yep.
Wow. Cool.
It's something to consider. I mean, I think it's the future. I mean, these are especially like the workloads that are kind of becoming pretty popular now with big data. You know, definitely it's not something where like, okay, well, forget about relational, like you're saying, Evan. It's there's a mix, right? There's typically we have applications that are using relational data, but then we have something else that maybe is doing analytics or something on top of that, which doesn't work as well with relational. It might work better because it's collecting data from many sources or something, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a, you know, because again, I mean, our audience hopefully is caught. I mean, I used to support SQL Server, and I've worked with a lot of customers over the years where they occasionally will just kind of cram something into a relational database that really doesn't fit with it, right? Okay. I mean, they're storing these big, you know, big files and things like that.
Images, yeah, that was my favorite one, yeah.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, SharePoint, right? I mean, all these things are in the database. But, I mean, it was just – part of it was because that's what they knew. But part of it was because while these other things, you know, things like DocumentDB, things like some of the other stuff we talked about today, just difficult to set up and get going if you didn't know what you were doing.
Yep.
So it became much, much easier to say, oh, you know what, I'll stick with what I know and I'll do it. But now that we've got, hey, I click a button and I have a DocumentDB database. Done. Right? I mean, that really opens it up to for people. So people should really definitely consider this stuff.
Now, yeah, okay, the other thing is... Do they have any GUI tools to help you front-end and test or develop against DocumentDB?
Yeah. So a lot of that's built into Portal now, and even the search stuff too. So you can go in and kind of tweak and play and actually even test queries out. They have like a whole query designer kind of thing up there in the Portal. You can see how your indexes are performing. I mean, there's a ton of data up there, a ton of different like little gadgets you can kind of play with to tweak your DocumentDB or see how it's performing. There's tons of telemetry in there about how many requests are coming up, how many documents per second, and I mean, there's a lot of stuff. The other thing too that drives some of these NoSQL, I think, is the other point with this guy approaching me and saying, "Hey, I got this idea for this thing. I don't really know what we want to do yet." You know, typically in the enterprise, when you're building an application, it's a process, right? I mean, there's a lot of work. There's architects involved. There's designing. There's guys building schemas and these kind of things. And then when you get to this point where it's just a couple guys trying to throw something together, it's very quick for me. Like, I don't have to go up there and worry about putting fields in. I can just we need to add another field. Okay, just put it in the UI and save it to DocumentDB, and it's there. Like, I don't have to go redesign. Now, obviously, I have to tweak the indexes and stuff when I do the queries, but in the portal, or through the API. But it's pretty quick to just start like changing stuff around. And say, nah, I don't like that. Let's try it this way and blow that away real quick and just try this. I love that fact about it,
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks, Kale.
Kale, thank you. Thanks again for that. And okay, then that's it's a wrap for the first episode of 2016. And hope for a good year with the Azure podcast, guys.
Sounds like a great start.
Yep.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.